Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Homicides have been increasing in Charlotte. Last year, 110 people were killed here, up from 89 in 2023 and the highest number since 2020. Around North Carolina, the picture is a mixed bag. Greensboro saw a 42% drop in homicides last year, but though Raleigh and Durham haven't released their final numbers for last year, their homicide counts were both up in the first half of the year. Meanwhile, the trend is down nationally. Across 85 cities, homicides dropped for the third straight year, down 17% since 2023. Another troubling trend here is the difficulty police departments, here and nationally actually, are having in attracting and retaining officers. As of last November, CMPD reported 300 vacancies, about 15% of its workforce. Is that part of the problem here? We look for answers to that question and for reasons behind our homicide rate this hour. Dan Redford is president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Fraternal Order of Police. He joins us along with Malcolm Graham, city councilman representing District 2. Danelle Gardner is manager of the Youth Advocate Program's Alternatives to Violence Program in the Bates Ford and West Boulevard area. And Roosevelt Brooks is the site supervisor for the Bates Ford area of the Youth Advocates Program Alternative to Violence. And Steve Harrison's also with us. He is a reporter for us. He reports on this and politics for WFAE News. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I should mention that we invited CMPD to send a representative for the program today. They declined. Malcolm Graham, I'm going to start with you as a member of City Council who recently said if people don't feel safe, they aren't safe. Perception is reality, and when Charlottians hear these crime statistics, they might think they are unsafe. So how would you characterize Charlotte's murder rate and its correlation to citizen safety?
Good morning, Mike, and good morning, everyone, and Happy New Year. I believe that as we move into this new year, and I just want to explain that Chief Jennings will be giving the 2024 year-end report on this coming Wednesday, and so I don't want to get ahead of framing the issue on his behalf, but certainly the numbers speak for themselves. You're absolutely right. If you don't feel safe, you're not safe. And throughout the city, whether you're in Uptown Charlotte or Bates Ford Road, Wilson Boulevard, Ballantyne, or University City, the perception that our community is unsafe, notwithstanding what the data may support, is what people are feeling, what people are talking about. They watch the news, they listen to your show, they even hear the president or the president-elect talk about how safe and how high crime rates have gone out throughout the country, although that's not true. They get a sense of an uneasy feeling as they walk out streets and they hear what's happening. And so as we look forward to the police report this week, for a deeper dive into the numbers, I stand by the statement that the perception throughout all the community is that we're not a safe city.
So what I'm asking you, Councilman, what I'm asking you is, as a councilman, as somebody who studies this, as somebody who's briefed on this constantly, as somebody who probably knows what's in the police report, and it doesn't matter whether you do or not, perception is reality, but is that perception real, in your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, it's depending on where you sit and where you stand. I think in some parts of the city, and again, I don't want to get ahead of the report, but I have not seen the report, so I'm anxiously waiting it, just like everyone else on this week from CMPD. But again, you know,
real.
People are
in
feeling words, that they are not it, in it, just like everyone city. Else on
there's
this
pockets
week from
where,
CMPD.
Crime,
but again, reported on, you know, on wide variety of media outlets demonstrates that we have a problem. The numbers speak for themselves. I'm on quarters throughout the city. I represent Uptown Charlotte in reference to where people work, live, and play. I see the news reports every day myself. There is a mold within our community of rising crime, and I look forward to getting the report from the chief to put those numbers in its proper perspective.
Donnell Gardner, you and your colleague Roosevelt Brooks help people find alternatives to violence. Those programs started, if I'm correct about this, in 2021. But we seem to be on this roller coaster in terms of homicides. If you just look at the numbers, in 2020, Charlotte had 118 killings. In 2021, it was down to 96. 2022, up to 107. 2023, down to 89. And last year, we experienced a 24% increase in homicides from 89 to 110. I'm going to start with you, Donnell. Are these programs, these alternative to violence programs and others, working?
I think these programs are working, but I think programs like this need to be implemented throughout the city. Like he mentioned, it's different pockets. But me, myself, personally, I can't say that I don't feel safe because I was raised in these type of environments. But I think if programs like ATV is implemented in the communities or those pockets that we're speaking about, I think that going in with the same approach, it would be beneficial because we are able to change the mindset of some of the individuals. We are able to tap into their family, provide basic needs that gives them an alternative. We also do our best to connect them with the resources they need after we've made our assessments. But if we can provide these type of organizations in all the areas that we feel is needed, I think it definitely will be a positive for the city.
Roosevelt, what's your take on that?
I follow up and agree with what Donnell just said. And one of the things I want to speak on and add is that with these type of programs, we're able to connect with families and even just more or less the younger people and bring them to a table and give them a voice in our program to where they can tell us exactly what they need and what keeps them from teetering into starting into a violent type of lifestyle. And more of these programs like this are necessary for those young youth and even some adults that are teetering into becoming more violent in the cities due to their living situations.
Steve Harrison's with us. He reports on this and many other things for WFAE News. And prior to that, he was with the Charlotte Observer. So you are keenly aware of what's been going on in Charlotte for years. And all of the numbers that I just gave out, Steve, were 2000 numbers, the year 2000 and beyond. How do they compare? How does our homicide rate compare to what was going on in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s?
I think the biggest comparison is going back to the early 90s when Charlotte would have 110, 120 homicides a year, about the same number we have today. But you have to remember, of course, Charlotte was about half as big as it was 35 years ago. So the homicide rate back in the early 90s was much, much higher. So that's something to keep into perspective. But then, you know, the other side is that if you go back about 10 years, Charlotte was averaging about 53 homicides a year. We've kind of doubled that over the last 5 years. But then I will then say again, if you compare us to a lot of other big American cities, our homicide rate is still much, much lower. So we've seen this disturbing trend in terms of the increase in homicides over the last 10 years. But if you compare us to many other big cities, we still look pretty favorably in terms of homicide rate.
Dan Redford's here. He's the president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Fraternal Order of Police. We know that America has this love affair with guns, but this goes beyond that. The people using guns to commit these murders aren't gun lovers. They're not gun advocates. Most of those folks are law-abiding citizens. So are guns the problem? Is it easy access to guns? Is it lax gun laws? Or are there other factors at work here?
Thank you, Mike, and good morning, everybody. No, I don't think it's a gun problem because obviously we've seen in attacks, you know, across the country where, you know, other weapons choices have been used to carry out attacks. I mean, we can just look to just a few weeks ago in New Orleans where somebody drove a car into a crowd of people. So I don't think it's a gun problem. It's not a knife problem. You know, this is a mindset problem. for, once somebody's made a decision, whether it's spur of the moment or something that's planned, you know, for whatever reason, these people are going out and thinking that this is the way that they need to end their beef. So, it's easy to blame guns because it's a hot topic, but I mean, I don't know how many guns we have in this country. If it was a gun problem, I think that, we would see a lot more homicides than what we do. So, in these crimes that are occurring, a lot of the offenders have prior records. They're, lawfully forbidden from even owning a firearm, but somehow they're still getting access to them. So, but going back to the root of your question is, no, I don't believe it's a gun problem at all.
I think it is, though, Daniel, and I want to push back a little bit on that. I think the proliferation of guns, the easy access of guns in inner city communities, you're absolutely right. Conflict resolution skills needs to be as a part of the problem as well. But the proliferation of guns, the availability of guns, the easy access of guns in communities is a problem that leads to people settling disputes with the firearm. So I don't think we should distance ourselves away from that.
But you've also said, Malcolm, that it is an attitude problem. If I understand your own comments correctly, recently you talked about how a lot of the homicides being committed by particularly young men, because they commit most of them, know their victims. You said that in your day, you solve these disputes in other ways. Fists come to mind, as opposed to using guns. So what has changed? Something has changed. Is it just easy access to guns, or is it a mindset problem?
It's the availability of the guns. I'm pretty sure a kid can find a gun within his neighborhoods, and the guys from ATV can speak better to this than I can, but the easy accessibility to the firearms and the lack of conflict resolution skills, this is not either or, it's both.
Donnell Gardner, you work with these young people, so do you, Roosevelt. I have about 2 minutes left in this segment. Let me ask you the same question. These young people see the impact of these homicides in their communities. They probably have friends or relatives or both whose lives have been lost to gun violence. One would think that that might make them think twice about using a gun to solve a problem. But when everyone has a gun, does that put those who might want to de-escalate at a disadvantage? Donnell.
Well, I think it could. I think it could in a sense, but I do think it's a mindset, lack of communication, with the lack of communication, it's going to be harder for conflict resolution. So I think that, going in, we got to continue to build these relationships, and we got to find a way to create programs to teach these youngins how to communicate, how to resolve. Because a lot of the incidents start with communication first. It starts out as a verbal altercation, and then it escalates. There's a lack of disrespect and value of life. So changing the mindset is something that we push very hard. We put forth a lot of effort in trying to tap into the mindset, because I truly believe that's where it starts.
Roosevelt, I only have about 30 seconds, but is that a difficult thing to do, to convince a young person not to put the gun down, not think it, just resolve it in some other way? Is that a difficult thing to convince them?
Mike, it's not a easy thing to do, but it's the effort that you have to put behind and the consistency that we have to stay the course and build these relationships. And also we have to listen to them. And a lot of times it's just lack of basic needs for them. And they have a choice to make. And unfortunately, some of them are making those bad choices, those bad decisions. And that's what we try to change.
We're looking at the proliferation of gun violence, particularly homicides in Charlotte. And we will continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Charlotte's rising homicide rate and some efforts to reduce that. Dan Redford is with us. He's the president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Fraternal Order of Police. City Council of District 2 Councilman Malcolm Graham is with us as well, as are Donnell Gardner and Roosevelt Brooks, both with the Alternative to Violence program, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Steve, there have been shootings uptown, sometimes in broad daylight, but is that the norm? Aren't most of these homicides confined to certain areas of town? And if so, which areas?
Yeah, I mean, just historically in Charlotte, most of the homicides, most of the violent crime has been in the so-called crescent of the city. You know, the neighborhoods from West Charlotte, north of uptown into East Charlotte, that are tend to residents there tend to have less money. There are fewer jobs, et cetera, et cetera. That has been the historic pattern, and that's still the pattern today. I think that the some of the headlines and some of the incidents in uptown, I believe that's a bit unusual just for my time here in Charlotte since 2006. There's always been crime uptown, but I feel like there has been more there have been more violence uptown, and I think that's really resonated with a lot of people. And if you combine that with, you know, it's what's happened to uptown in terms of people working from home and not coming into work. It's had this kind of double impact on Center City, where people just don't particularly feel good about going there.
Hmm. The statistics surrounding homicides last year here are familiar. 65% of people killed were Black, 20% Hispanic, 12% white. 80% of the victims were male with an average age of about 31. Malcolm, our arguments were the most cited reasons for this violence, followed by instances of domestic violence and drug-related incidents. That accounts for the victims. Who were the perpetrators? Malcolm.
Well, generally, again, the perpetrators tend to be people that the victims knew in many cases. As we said earlier in our presentations, where they are relationship types of scenarios where someone gets into a disagreement and resolves it themselves through violence. And so I think we have to work extremely hard to understand that fact. And then secondly, it's just working to ensure that as a city, and the council now is working, we will receive a presentation tonight actually relating to our Safe Charlotte initiative, which is wraparound services that takes into consideration a wide variety of departments and agencies working together to reduce crime. And so laying the foundation for the report that we will receive from the police chief later this week. And so just getting an understanding of the cases and the causes and the violent crime, the property crimes, juvenile crimes, gun violence, those type of stats and figures will be released this week, so we can get a better understanding about who they are, who's committing the crimes, where the crimes are existing in 2024, et cetera.
Dan Redford, these homicides are coming at a time when police departments across the country are experiencing difficulty in recruiting and retaining officers, and some departments report low morale. And when Charlotte experienced an increase in the number of officers who have lost their lives in the line of duty, that certainly must have contributed to a loss of morale and maybe a more difficult time in recruiting. How would you assess the atmosphere at CMPD?
I mean, I can tell you that you know, among our CMPD members that provide us with feedback, you know, morale has been an issue in this department for the last several years, with
why?
Some people saying, why? Well, I mean, you look at how law enforcement has been treated over the past few years. I mean, we have been vilified. We've been made out to be the bad guy. We've made martyrs out of people that, that police are getting involved in incidents in. And, you know, the law enforcement are out there doing their jobs, and there are mechanisms put in place that when an officer does something wrong, they're held accountable for it. And we don't have an issue with that. But when you've got members on Charlotte City Council that are going out and protesting the police, advocating to disarm CMPD, and I'm talking about Braxton Winston, voted against everything that was beneficial to the police department, you know, that really weighs on officers. And then when you have, an internal leadership culture that officers do not feel is beneficial for them, it creates a lot of stress. And a lot of added pressure on officers to go out there and do the job because they're put under a microscope.
But would you deny that there have been undeniable instances of police overreach and overreaction and mistreatment of suspects? Not just here, but around the country.
Correct. I mean, and like I said, I mean, there are mechanisms that are put in place that are to deal with that. What a district attorney or what the prosecutor's office in these areas, choose to do with those cases. But another thing too is you got to understand that a lot of the information that comes out initially are 5 minute or 5 second clips of an incident, and it doesn't really showcase the entire incident as a whole as to what led up to it. So we can't make a decision based off of a 5 second video or off something that's been edited, which we find is commonly done. But by the time the facts come out and the truth comes out, we've already ran with a narrative as to what people want to believe. And it just makes it a lot harder to really see past some of that, and get to the end and find the truth in it.
I want to reiterate hold on. I want to reiterate that Dan Redford is the president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Fraternal Order of Police. He's not speaking necessarily for Charlotte-Mecklenburg PD. And those folks were invited on the program, but they declined to be here. Malcolm, go ahead.
Well, on behalf of the city council, we have made so much progress in working with our police chief, who is doing, from my perspective, an excellent job providing the resources to the police department, whether it's more monies for additional officers, whether it's more dollars for 911 operators, whether we're working with CMPD on our Safe Charlotte initiative, which talks about a wide variety of things that we have done to collaborate with CMPD during the George Floyd era. One council member doesn't speak for the entire city council. Mm-hmm. I think the council and the management staff and the mayor has done a good job in terms of putting our best foot forward to ensure that there's a balanced approach to law enforcement, that we hold our officers accountable, but at the same time, giving them the resources necessary to do their jobs in an effective and an efficient manner. Steve. Like I said, tonight, we will continue to have that conversation about reviewing our Safe Charlotte initiative. Actually, tonight, we look forward to, again, working with Chief Jennings and getting the numbers later this week. And then later in February, Mike, we will begin to review our violence as a public health crisis initiative with Mecklenburg County. So I don't want to leave the impression that somehow the city council has not been focused on this issue. We've been focused on this issue for the last 2 or 3 years. There is no microwave solution to solving crime in Charlotte. We've been proactive in taking the necessary steps and supporting law enforcement each and every step of the way.
Steve, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I was just going to say, after some of the things that Daniel was saying about morale in CMPD, I think it is interesting to look back at how the department has changed. If you go back to 2009, CMPD would make in a year about, I remember, 32,000 arrests. And that's gone way down. It's down to about 15,000 a year. And I think that a lot of officers, the term is often like proactive policing, that kind of like engaging when you don't necessarily have to. I think a lot of officers do feel hesitant about doing that. And so I think it is an important thing. I'm not saying one leads to another, but if you just look at this period of homicides that we're talking about, it's been a big change in Charlotte. It's also been a big change nationwide in terms of this issue of proactive policing. And I just always think that's a part of the discussion that's not talked about that much.
Malcolm, you have advocated, if I'm not mistaken, a more aggressive police response to this rise in homicides. What specifically, if that's accurate, did you have in mind?
Well, I'm advocating that we enforce the laws that are currently on the book. I believe, like I said earlier, in the broken window syndrome. If you see a broken window and you don't fix it, then that leads to other things in the community. We made a number of investments along the corridors of opportunities, specifically Batesford Road and the South Street. And, you know, there are a number of issues there that dealing with convenience stores, dealing with fortified beer, liquor, and wine sales at these stores, lottering at these stores, open selling of marijuana in some cases. And so I think we just need to enforce the laws that are currently on the books, protecting people's constitutional rights. And I went to a neighborhood meeting just last week, and the neighbors themselves have said, we want aggressive police enforcement of the laws that are already on the book, whether it's Batesford Road or Freedom and Wilkerson Boulevard, that neighborhood leaders, business owners on these corridors are saying that what we're currently doing is simply not working. And it's a double-edged sword. Do we want to keep police officers off the beat because they're processing petty crimes? Or do we allow the petty crimes to amount to something significantly different in the future? It's a fine line that we have to walk, but I think there are enough laws that are currently on the books that if we have a significant conversation with our police chief, our district attorney, the magistrate court, to make sure that we're all on the same page in terms of how do we begin to be assertive and addressing some of these minor offenses before they turn into something like a murder.
Danelle, when you're working with these young people and trying to convince them to put down their guns and solve their disputes in different ways, does CMPD, does the city of Charlotte appear to be, in their minds, soft on crime?
Well, you know, listening to Daniel and also talking about the community, we use the term morale and stress. So you're talking about a department that's dealing with low morale and stress, and you're talking about a community that's dealing with low morale, stress, that's been traumatized for years. Trust factors are low. That's why it's so important for us to build these relationships. These relationships are so important with police and community. It's a detachment there. And somewhere we got to put forth a better effort to mend those relationships with community and police. And I think the understanding will be better if we truly put forth those efforts. It's just so important, even with he mentioned about the stores. The stores, they have an opportunity to communicate with these people. And I think if they communicated what they needed or what they would allow and not allow, I mean, it's the effort that you put behind it.
Give me an example. Give me an example of that. Stores communicating with these folks about what they will allow and what they won't allow. Well, what are you talking about?
What I'm saying, he spoke about loitering at the stores could end up being a issue. I think those store owners, that's the issue for the store owners to take care of. And, you know, in a serious manner, because if you own a business and people hung out at your business, then that's on you. As a business owner, you need to put forth the efforts to prevent those if that's where a lot of incidents are happening. That's what I'm speaking of.
Dan, police have often bemoaned how difficult it is to get people to step forward in the aftermath of a homicide to help them identify the perpetrators. And yet, CMPD has identified suspects in about 72% of the city's homicides just this last year, which is above the national average of success. How are they managing that when they're down 15% of the force? How are they doing this?
I mean, I think it just goes to show you the dedication that our homicide division at the Charlotte Police Department has. Going back, you know, to what's being said here and what Danelle just referenced is, you know, I mean, it's about relationships. It's about building trust and about ensuring that, you know, when people come and speak to the police, that it's done so, in a positive manner. You know, unfortunately, you know, it's the circumstances are the result of violence. But police have to be trusted. And I think that's the overwhelming opinion of everybody here. I know Malcolm spoke about it, and Danelle and Roosevelt both spoke about it. you know, we have to have positive relationships. You know, one of the things that's kind of suffered within CMPD over the last few years is our community coordinators. You know, back in the day, we used to have six officers that were assigned as community coordinators per division. You know, now, according to CMPD's website, Metro and North Tryon Division each only have three. These are two divisions within CMPD that have seen a high level of violence in there. And the Uptown Division, according to CMPD's website, only has two community coordinators. So we've lost a lot of this vital, these vital offices that are out there, you know, who are boots on the ground, that are talking with people and building those relationships to ensure that when stuff does happen, they know they have a network to be able to relay information. So, you know, I mean, it's just frustrating, but, you know, it's the dedication of these men and women that are out here that are wearing the badge, that are out there trying to find justice for victims and their families. And, you know, I think that CMPD does have a good reputation as far as, you know, throughout the community, that there is that level of trust there. And that's why I think that a lot of these homicides are getting solved.
Roosevelt, is there that level of trust in your mind among these young people? And would more relationships through community policing help in reducing the number of homicides, because they would be interacting with officers who might be able to tell them there are other ways to solve disputes?
The trust factor, I think, is a major, major issue. But I also think that there's optimism to look forward to when we can bring each other together. I think sometimes that disconnect is from both sides. And until we all approach this violence as a disease, is exactly what it is. I think that's a major thing, because it is truly a disease in these communities. But when we start talking about trusting, we as ATV members, we have to build that trust with these young men and young ladies that we work with. And that takes time. They have to trust us and to understand that we have their best interests at heart, and that what we're trying to do is change their mindset, and also help them change their trajectory of their life and where they want to go, and not where they are right now. But as far as the trust issue, I think that is something that we have to stay optimistic about, because if we lose that, then we're fighting a battle that we can't win.
Roosevelt Brooks is the Bates Ford Road Area Coordinator for the Alternatives to Violence Program, part of the Youth Advocate Program. We will continue our conversation in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Charlotte's rising homicide rate, and other things surrounding all of that, with Steve Harrison, reporter for WFAE News. Dan Redford is president of the Charlotte Mecklenburg Fraternal Order of Police. Malcolm Graham is Charlotte City Council District 2 representative. And we're also here with Danelle Gardner, who's the manager of the Youth Advocate Program's Alternative to Violence Program, and Roosevelt Brooks, who is the site supervisor for that program in the Bates Ford Road corridor. Dan, you've pointed to the state's Raise the Age law as having an impact on our rising homicide rate. Remind us of what that law did and tell us why you believe it may be a contributing factor. Dan.
Oh, I mean, I think if you just look at the statistics on our increase in homicides, I mean, you can overlay that to the Raise the Age law. I mean, we've had a significant increase of juvenile crime over the last several years since that law was enacted. Fortunately, the legislation amended that just last year to make it so that juveniles can be charged with adult crimes. You know, I want to be cautious on saying it, because, you know, I don't want to undermine what Roosevelt and Danelle are doing, because I think it's doing great work. But, you know, we've got to get to a point to where when, you know, juveniles are making decisions that is outside of what they're capable of handling, you know, that we have to have a justice system, you know, that reacts accordingly and holds offenders accountable. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean that juveniles got to get thrown in prison for the rest of their life, but, you know, we've got to have accountability, because whenever people are not held accountable, it's not going to send a message that, you know, that, you know, that that we've got to stop this, you know, because, you know, the court system is, you know, in Mecklenburg County is challenging in itself. You know, when we see bonds, you know, on violent offenders being extremely low and people are able to get right back out. And in some cases, you know, they reoffend again while they're out. So, but, you know, I was glad to hear that the raise the age law did get amended. But to me, I think that that's just been a downfall as far as the juvenile crime that we've been seeing.
Donnell, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, the term he used, accountability. I mean, there has to be accountability. I'm sorry. And when things happen, you know, the law take the lead in doing what they have to do. I mean, that's just what it is. But accountability is definitely, you know, it has to take place for individuals to understand what they've done. So yeah, that's very important. Okay. Accountability.
Steve, in 2021, the General Assembly passed this legislation that decriminalized local ordinances unless cities and towns voted to re-criminalize them. We had a lot of discussion on this when public urination and other behaviors were causing problems uptown and in Fourth Ward. Our city chose to keep the decriminalized nature of those behaviors, while some infractions like shooting a gun inside or in public were recriminalized. These behaviors are a far cry from homicides, but do they indicate a more permissive stance than we had in prior years that could open the door to more lawlessness? Steve, you're muted. Unmute yourself.
I'm sorry. I think that whole issue that we saw in Uptown about public urination and defecation and open container, it kind of goes back to what Councilmember Graham said about, you know, broken windows theory of policing, that small things can lead to bigger problems. That was one where the city kind of by default had chose not to make those offenses criminal. And then last summer, I believe it was last summer, it was a really pretty controversial decision on city council to make those offenses criminal again. And I think that shows that this city council is often torn between a more hardline approach to public safety and quality of life issues versus a what others would say is kind of a compassionate, let's not criminalize homelessness. And so I think that was a really interesting case because it was something that was really challenging for council to do.
Is this tied in any way, Steve, to CMPD's backing away from what is called proactive policing? Are we doing what we used to do in that area, or have we moved away from that?
I mean, I think that a lot of officers, I will give an example. When I first moved here in 2006 and my car registration was expired and I would drive around, I would get pulled over immediately for that. I mean, that was just like, it was within a month I would get pulled over, and that's not the case anymore. And so there is a sense among officers, and I think this comes from city council and city administration, to do less of that kind of thing. It can be dangerous. It can lead to bad outcomes. And so I think you do see that, not just in terms of traffic stops, but a lot of other things as well, where there's a sense that it's just not worth it. For the city, for the officer. And like I said earlier on the show, there has been, if you look at the statistics, there's been a clear indication in that in terms of fewer citations, fewer arrests.
Dan.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what Steve said is, you know, I would have to disagree on there being an unwillingness of officers to want to enforce that. You know, I mean, you know, yes, traffic stops are dangerous. I mean, the job of law enforcement is inherently dangerous in itself, but you know, like officers, I know they will want to go out there and they want to do traffic stops. They want to do, I mean, writing a citation or pulling a car over for an expired registration, I mean, that's an easy thing to do. It's a compliance issue. As long as you get your registration renewed, you know, the person that's written that ticket doesn't even have to, you know, pay anything other than just their renewal fee. But, you know, I think officers, they want to be proactive. They want to get out there. They want to do the things that we were used to doing years ago. It's just unfortunate that as the city has grown, the staffing at the police department has not kept up I think it's I think in comparison to the population of the city and then in the unincorporated areas that CMPD are responsible for, I think we need to be at 2,500 officers. And I think the last number is roughly just over 1,700. So with that, there's just so many calls for service that are coming in. I mean, we've been talking about all the violent stuff here, but just the mundane, the domestics, the car accidents, and a lot of the other issues that come in, officers are too busy dealing with that they can barely even manage those, let alone stopping cars. They don't have any free time to do it. So it's just a growing frustration because officers would love to do it. They just don't have the ability to be able to do it.
And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Dan, CMPD is down about 300 officers. By officers, do they mean people on the street, on the beat, in the cars, walking the streets, or are they talking about peripheral personnel?
That would be everyone, including command staff, supervisors, and everything. I think CMPD's allocated about 1,926 officers. You know, so you take 300 away from that and you get your number. But but we've got over 1 million people in this county alone, and we've got 1,700 officers. Maybe 800 of those are actually answering calls. But that's covering a 24-hour shift across 14 divisions, including the airport. So. Like I said, I think a city our size with the population we have, you know, I think that even that 1900 number that is allocated is dangerously low.
So, Malcolm, the city of LA is being questioned about decisions they made in cutting funding to their fire department, which may or may not have contributed to their ability to fight those horrendous, extraordinary fires they are experiencing right now. And I'm sure funding is but one of the factors out there, but it's different when you compare it to our homicide challenge. However, in your mind, is the city funding CMPD and its efforts to reduce those homicides to a sufficient degree? Would you support increasing their budget to address officer shortages and their ability to face rising crime? Do we have Malcolm? Clearly, we do not have Malcolm. Okay, I'm sorry about that. We'll try to reestablish contact, and I'll ask that question again because I think it's an important question to ask. Donnell, programs like yours, the Alternative to Violence program, take time to work. Talk a moment about what you do, what your programs focus on, and how they work.
Okay. And just to piggyback on what he said, the shortage in law enforcement is the reason why it's so important for organizations like ATV to be implemented throughout the city, boots on the ground. So our approach, knowing that violence is a public health issue, our approach is like attacking the disease. We detect, we interrupt, we go in and change the norms of the community by providing different alternatives. And we approach the high-risk individuals. We support them. We build those relationships. And like we said before, it goes back to those relationships. It's so important. We have some individuals, they may not want to be on a part of the program as a participant, but they're key individuals because, you know what I'm saying, they look out for us in the community. We also are able to work with them as well. Some individuals just don't want to be on paperwork, like we spoke about in our community, the trust factor is low. But that's why those relationships are so important. So what we have is what you call violence interrupters, credible messages. Those are individuals from the area that's relatable, credible. They can go into these neighborhoods and build those relationships that we're talking about. It's so important. We have what you call outreach workers. Those outreach workers, they work in forms of guidance counselors. They recruit these high-risk individuals. They make assessments. After those assessments, they help them reach their goals, connect them with resources, provide basic needs, things of that nature. And then we try to even extend it. Although we're talking about violence, we try to extend those efforts to preventive measures by dealing with the younger groups, because we target ages from 14 to 25. But also, like we said, once we get into the individuals, we extend it out to their families and help them with education, jobs, and things of that nature.
These programs are
talking to communities. When you can come inside these communities, build that trust factor, and make something happen for them, because they've seen people come and go. So what we do is be consistent. Consistency is so important with helping us do our job.
These programs, Roosevelt, are only about 4 years old. I think they started in 2021, so it may be too early to assess how effective they are. But can you take a stab at that? And can you also tell us if you think that you are reaching the young people who are most prone to committing these homicides? Are you getting them? It's difficult to prove a negative, but are you getting them before they might have pulled the trigger, and therefore they will never pull the trigger?
Yes, I think that those efforts that we're putting forth are very effective in the communities, especially when we have live action type of action. When we walk up on a fight, or we walk up on two gentlemen arguing, and you hear conversations about, hey, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that, and we can successfully get in between those situations, and break that up, and then have a positive outcome with Forrest, hey, let's talk about this. You know, those are the type of success things, that stories that we take pride in, because it's happening. And this is the type of work we do, it's something that we know when we go out every day that it's going to be a tough road, but at the end of the day, it's necessary in these communities. So that's the reason why we fight so hard to protect our community and be a positive impact on the community.
Dan, homicides in Greensboro are down 42%. They are a smaller city than Charlotte, but homicide rates are also falling in cities like Baltimore, New Orleans, and Philadelphia. So what are they doing differently? Are conditions in those cities somehow different? Are the tactics used by police or the practices used by police somehow different? Do their departments have more and or better resources than CMPD?
You named a lot of cities there. To be honest with you, I don't know what they're doing there, but I know I did read an article last night. I think it was Boston, where the mayor there had spoken about, you know, putting a lot of emphasis behind community policing. And I think community policing is important. You know, meeting people and getting to know everybody, and working with organizations that Donnell and Roosevelt are a part of. I mean, I think that's what's instrumental in really kind of preventing a lot of these things. So, I mean, it makes the argument harder to say that the crime in Charlotte is a national trend. I don't like it when law enforcement agencies say, hey, our problems are everybody's problems, because I really think it just dilutes the true problem. You know, we need to be focusing on Charlotte, or focusing on whatever agency it is that you're on, instead of trying to compare us nationally, because, you know, what happens in these other cities as far as homicides, while tragic, you know, there's not really much connection here. So whatever they're doing, I'm sure that it's a lot of what we are doing here, maybe a little bit more aggressively. I don't know what their staffing issues are, but, you know, obviously, I mean, this is a joint effort between a lot of entities. You know, I mean, their court systems there could be better. I know our court system here we've been very critical of some of the judicial officials, rulings and bond applications. I know the DA's office is extremely underfunded, so some of the decisions on plea deals made, is horrible to hear. But, you know, like I said, I mean, those are the issues that we face here that I think that we need to look ourselves in the mirror and find out what it is we're doing wrong, and change what we're doing so that we can get these violent crimes down.
And Steve, you alluded to this a moment ago. You reported on the last city council meeting at which city staff gave a presentation on public safety as part of the city's holistic approach to fighting crime. You wrote about the city's focus on quality of life issues, but that some council members believe the city needs to be more focused on what CMPD is doing to curtail homicide. So what was city staff, and I only have less than a minute left, what were they proposing?
Yeah, this was one part of an overall discussion where they were really, in this presentation, they were focused on things like clearing out trash from empty lots, et cetera, things like that. You know, broken windows type things.
Streetlights.
Like you said, Mike, some council members wanted, you know, they were a little impatient. They wanted to know what's going on at CMPD.
Steve Harrison's a reporter for WFAE News. This is a story that we will continue to follow as we go through the year here. Dan Redford, president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Fraternal Order of Police. Malcolm Graham was with us. He's City Council District 2. And Roosevelt Brooks and Danelle Gardner, both with the Youth Advocate Program and the Alternative to Violence Program. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.